ist Tod auf Sepertex. Romulus est Remund est nahe der Retex.
Romulus et Remus Sanium Dionibus. Deo erat sum est ama vada vorum. Sirian est senatra est ala perpes. Romulus et Remus est nahe der Retex.
Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Yes, that was not our usual Klingon music, but this is Bound by Honor, the KAG Klingon Book Review Podcast. The reason we had different music today is to honor our guests who will be joining us to talk about the original series book number 35, The Romulan Way. Everybody, let's get ourselves introduced. I am Jajim.
I'm Jorn.
I'm Javon.
And our guests are...
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Kathy.
Okay, and Ryan and Kathy are from our KAG Xeno Legions. And would you like to tell us just a little bit about what that is about?
The Imperial Xeno Legion is another division of KAG. And what we do is we are for the aliens that are not Klingons. So anybody that's interested in joining KAG but prefers to be another alien like Romulan or Andorian or any other alien from Star Trek, we would be glad to have you.
Okay, that is outstanding. And so... Sean, would you like to introduce us to this book?
The Romulan Way is written a little bit differently than most other novels that we've reviewed or that you'll see out there on the bookshelves. In that, in the Romulan Way, we're trying to learn a lot about the Romulan culture and the Romulan Foundation founding. To do this, the authors, Diane Duane and Peter Morwood, have chosen to interweave a story with chapters of Romulan history. So the first chapter will be on what the story is. The second chapter will be on Romulan history. The third chapter, back to the story. The fourth chapter, and on and on and on through the end of the book. This particular book is... as far as I can tell from the book, from the writings in the book, takes place about 8 years after the events of the Ultimate Computer in the Star Trek TV series, and that it's referred to as she could have gone on that mission, but instead she went on a mission to Romulus. Interestingly enough, I don't know how about the rest of you, but I have a copy of the first printing of the book, and golly gee, it looks like there's a Battlestar Galactica Viper in the background on the cover of the book. So,
yeah, same with mine. It looks like there's two of them under McCoy's head.
I haven't quite figured out what that second ship is. But it looks like something from another book series. I want to say Gateway or something like that. But it's different than Galactica. But the other one is definitely an original series Viper. A brief summary of the plot from the back of the book. They are a race of warriors, a noble people to whom honor is all. They are cousin to the Vulcans, ally to the Klingons, and Starfleet's most feared and cunning adversary. They are the Romulans, And for 8 years, the Federation agent, Teresa Labrato, has hidden in their midst. Now, the presence of a captured Starfleet officer forces her to make a fateful choice between exposure and escape, between maintaining her cover and saving the life of Dr. Leonard McCoy. Here is a startlingly different adventure. Is the truth behind one of the most fascinating alien races ever created in Star Trek, the Romulans.
Okay. And incidentally, on I'm not sure if it's Memory Alpha or Memory Beta, it does say that those ships that are pictured on the front cover are both Battlestar Galactica Vipers. Just thought I'd throw that in. So, Javon, why don't you give us your overall impressions of the book?
I was not particularly impressed with this one like the last one. I actually didn't mind the history chapters. If anything, they were a welcome break from the other storyline, which was just, in my opinion, complete nonsense. I'm fine with the undercover stuff. It's just the whole McCoy plot where he gets himself intentionally kidnapped, and it's all hinging on the hope that he gets put, he's made his prison cells put in some random dude's basement. I actually really didn't care for this book that much. If they cut out all that crap and it was just like a paper on the Romulan Vulcan history, I probably would have actually enjoyed it more.
Okay, and Ryan and Kathy, your overall impressions, do you agree with Javon?
I actually, I like the book, and maybe it's just because I like the Romulans so much. I'm willing to, you know, kind of suspend some disbelief. I did think it was strange that McCoy was the one that was used in this story. But, you know, here we have it. It was all intentional that he was put in that same house where the main Romulan character was. So that part, I mean, you can see how it goes with the story. And it was an interesting story, I mean, to me, because I love the Romulans, I suppose, that. And because the Romulan history was very interesting to read. This is a race that we really don't know much about their history from Star Trek. I mean, from all the shows and movies, there's not as much about the Romulans. So it was, you know, it was great. Well, even when the book was written in the 80s, it was great to see all this and to learn all of their history.
Yeah, out of the two halves of the book, I prefer the Romulan history half more so. It was pretty outrageous to put McCoy in those situations. But knowing that the author, Diane Duane, is a registered nurse, she prefers to work with the medical field and characters within the medical field. So knowing that background about her, I think that she put McCoy in for that reason.
Okay, and John?
My problem with putting McCoy in that situation, I can understand that Diane is more comfortable working with medical people, but why would Starfleet intelligence put a non-intelligence agent in a situation like that rather than a intelligence agent that the Romulans might also want from, say, the Enterprise crew or whatever, what am I looking for, award, prize, that particular person could be to the Romulans? It just, his whole mission just didn't make sense to me.
I agree with everybody. Why would you put McCoy in this position? But then when I thought about it, and you go back and you talk about the Enterprise incident where the cloaking device was stolen, I thought maybe this would make McCoy a more enticing target and more likely that they wouldn't just kill him out of hand, that they would definitely want to make a big show trial of everything and parade him around and say, look who we caught, and then put him off. So
that is something they said in the book, that they wanted the famous McCoy from the famous Enterprise, mm-hmm. something like that. So they did want him to stand trial. Another reason I think the authors used him, like they could have used, you know, Kirk or Spock, but then it would have been a different story. You would expect Kirk to try to escape. And even if the whole thing was planned, you know, the Romulans would still wonder, you know, like why he didn't try to escape. They know that he wouldn't just sit there. And McCoy was was playing out the part. He was right for the part because he could just stay in the prison and or in the, you know, in the cellar and, you know, just walk out to the garden sometimes and talk to Arai, the Romulan woman.
Okay, so I'm going to take a guess here and say that probably the McCoy part of this plot is probably not our favorite part of the story. So maybe if we can get through that one, that part of it kind of quickly, and then we can get into the part that everybody seemed to like, and that was the Romulan history. McCoy was, I don't know, he seemed not totally very McCoy-like until, of course, he got into the Romulan Senate and reserved his right of, what was it called again? Right of statement, I believe.
Statement.
Yeah. And then he started talking about mint juleps and all this other stuff. I'll tell you what, that part of this story had me rolling on the floor.
Oh yeah. It's not McCoy that I had the issue with. It's what they were doing with McCoy. I thought him going into that, before the Senate and then talking about his family recipes and talking about how you don't put beans in a chili, I thought that was hilarious. But it was the idea that they put him undercover and all these things just happened to work out in his favor. He could have ended up anywhere, and the mission would have been a failure. If it just turned out it was a coincidence that he was kidnapped and ended up at that house, and they sent, I forget the name of the rock guy in there to go save him, and it was more of a coincidence, and it was all just kind of more of a coincidence, I would have bought the story more than him being a deep cover agent.
That's Lieutenant Nerath. Or some of that. He was also in the first book.
Yes, which I did appreciate because he was a great character.
The thing about the Horda, too, was how the Romulans were so fascinated with him. That was interesting in this book and the previous book. In the previous book, it was Aiel, and then in this book, Arai, how they both went, he's such a strange creature. It's a rock that can talk. It was a great little relief, you know, comic relief for the book.
But here's a thought, and I just want you guys to think about it, because we talked about why use McCoy, why not use Kirk or Spock? If you had thrown Kirk or Spock in, and they attempted escapes, and the Romulans are going to catch them each time and bring them back because it's going to have to be a show trial at the end, in those escapes, you can use their adventures in the Romulan civilization, in Romulan cities, amongst Romulan populace to explore Romulan culture.
Yes, that would have been interesting. And the way the book was written, we still got to see a few things because Arai went out, you know, she went out to market. And I think that was the idea. They just wanted to show how the more common people, besides the mm-hmm. military, how yeah. they lived their lives.
And she drove like a bat out of hell, apparently.
She was a great driver, wasn't she?
I think if you ask her passengers, they disagree.
Yeah, you think that was the human in her, just, you know, the way she drives?
I don't know, but that is an interesting point.
Well, we could all use a little bit of excitement, I guess. That may have been the only excitement in her life before.
She did comment about the fact that she really loved it when she got her hands on the flyer.
Maybe she should have been a shuttle pilot.
But then she would have still been in Starfleet and not on Romulus.
That is true. And so with her life here as the servant master, she didn't get to drive much. So maybe that's really the reason she liked it, because it was something she didn't get to do as often.
And her mission on Romulus was served more by her being a servant. She moves up to be the servant master. And I believe at the end of this book, she's being appointed to the Senate.
And that is another good point, the way a Romulan can move up. And I don't think it really happens much in their society that way for a servant master to be a senator. I believe they did say a lot of those positions are inherited, or you might get them through treachery or through knowing people. And so she moved up the way we think of here in this country. You would think that you do it by merit.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in this case, the merit that she had was false because it was all around McCoy's escape. And it's interesting how she got into the position of being a senator by becoming a hero, but she actually really didn't do anything but play a part.
which gets us back to, it would have made more sense to me as a reader if McCoy had been, the McCoy character had been an intelligence agent, because it does look like all of this stuff was planned out, including that McCoy is assigned to her family.
Well, it was all planned out. I mean, the attack on the vessel that McCoy was on, was all set up. The whole thing was a setup for McCoy to go back and make contact with an agent that had been out of touch, because they felt like she had gone over to the Romulans wholly. She was continuing to be an agent, but at the same time, she has come to view Romulus as her home.
The whole McCoy story was a bit over the top. It was like McCoy as James Bond.
And that just doesn't fit the McCoy character. Again, I could see that as either the Kirk character or the Spock character pulling that kind of Bondishness off. But, you know, especially Kirk. Kirk could really be into bondage. But aside from that, they would be more the intelligence agents than McCoy would be.
Well, since you mentioned it, I think that if there was an intelligence agent, he would almost be too much like the Romulans that were there, because they had so many of the that the subcommander, was it Tronwy, that tried to make a deal with the housemaster. I mean, there were covert things, secret things like that, and maybe the story needed McCoy to contrast with that. He is not going to be covert, except for the part about his escape.
I just figured out a way that they could have settled that whole thing. If they had had an intelligence agent going in once or twice saying they were McCoy, because if I recall, the Romulans really hadn't gotten a good picture of McCoy from the Enterprise incident, but then those agents were caught. So Starfleet security realized, oh, we've got to send the actual guy in, because they're going to catch the fakes anytime we try to send a fake in.
I suppose another thing you could think about, though, in this case is, if it had been Kirk that was going in to play this part, he might have been killed out of hand because he was the commander of the Enterprise that stole the cloaking device. If it had been Spock successfully seduced a Romulan commander, and which probably could have gotten him in quite a bit of trouble. They would not want to publicly acknowledge that Spock was able to do this to a Romulan commander. So then the third person in the triumvirate would have to be Dr. McCoy. As not logical as it is, there's your choice. If you had chosen someone else as an operative, then you wouldn't have the star appeal to sell the book.
It was probably more, of a plot point to have someone who was someone that we're familiar with, like McCoy. But yes, like just the points like you made that Spock and Kirk, the story would have been completely different, and they wanted it to go a certain way in this book to have the showing the life of Arai and then of course the trial. I kind of think the Romulans wanted the trial no matter who it was. But for McCoy to go in and do his filibuster was great, and Spock and Kirk would have done that completely differently.
Okay, let's talk about some of the other characters. We talked a little bit about Arai, and then we have other characters in here that are just as interesting, high-ranking Romulans.
There was the sub-commander, Tronwy, who was the one that tried to make a deal with Dayan, the House Lord, about, well, give us McCoy, and he wanted to torture him for a while and then kill him. And it took him like a little time to think about it, but then he finally decided with honor that he was not going to give McCoy away just for that to happen, just for him, because the sub-commander would have been able to restore his glory and give him a higher position in the Empire, but he decided it wasn't worth that. I mean, that was great to show, a Romulan with honor and another Romulan who was prominent who didn't have honor.
I liked how those two guys played off of each other too. And it would have been interesting if they had added in the textbook aspect of it a situation similar to this where a high-ranking enemy is kidnapped in somebody else's house and that guy sold them off to the highest bidder, and to see the consequences of that. So you know, so you get more of an idea of what the guy's getting into, about how there could be a back, because I didn't understand why this was a thing and why he just didn't do it. Like, I get it has to do with the honor of him and all that stuff, but it's like, why would they put him in a position where he could do this in the first place if they don't want him to sell McCoy?
Yeah, they must have. Yeah, it's like no one thought that someone would like make him that offer, really.
Or if that house was chosen by the sub commander because he was the one who kidnapped him, he chose the house. He knew that guy was a praetor, so he was allowed to take inmates like this, but he knew he was also disgraced, so he could have been easily bought in his own opinion. If they explained that, then I would have been on board for this 100%, but it's just, I was just slightly confused at why this whole situation was happening in the first place.
Another interesting thing in the story was that it seems like the Romulans don't have friends as we would, you know, like we consider making friends to be a good thing. And it looks like Arai, her only friend was the, if anyone, it was her lord master of the house. And even the master, Trakalian, he didn't seem to have any friends either. It's like everyone kind of works on their own in this world.
And speaking of the master of the house, did he know that she was a spy? Because at one point he comes out and says it. I'm like, wait, is he joking or does he actually know? And it was never too entirely clear after that, at least to me.
Yeah, I think he really didn't know. I mean, maybe he, the book kind of, I think they try to taunt you with that idea, but I had the impression that he didn't really know, and no one knew, which brings up the point, you know, what if she needed a doctor? What if someone found out that her blood is red or something? But it looks like she never got revealed in those 8 years that she was there.
Yeah, and that, and when he said that line that about the traitor, I was like, oh, he knows. That's how McCoy ended up here. He's a double agent, and he arranged for McCoy to get here. That's what all these fancy parties have been about, him securing enough influence to do this. And it never goes anywhere. So I'm like, so he didn't know? What's going on?
See, I had the thought all the way through this thing as I was reading it, is what if she had become injured somehow? And then wound up at the doctor's office, and the doctor does an examination and finds that her internal anatomy is completely different. I mean, in 8 years on a planet, somebody's going to catch a cold or the flu or something like that, or maybe even some debilitating disease that the Romulans have immunity to, but that a human would not. It just seemed kind of interesting to me that she never got sick and never had a reason to see a doctor.
She talked about how she bled green blood now, and at least I think she made I'm assuming that wasn't a symbolic thing. So I was under the assumption that they rearranged her organs so that it made sense for a Romulan anatomy.
Oh, see, I thought that was symbolic myself, but I could be wrong.
I was taking it as both, that she bled green as she was Romulan and she was also physically Romulan, but you could be right too. It could have just been symbolism.
Now, for most of this book, I myself was trying to figure out, how does this tie in with the book before? And I thought it was actually kind of crafty how they brought in Anhui, Subcommander Anhui, to perform the rescue with the Bloodwing.
Yeah, that was a good call. I was wondering the same thing that when the Horta guy showed up. I figured that was going to be the connection and the Enterprise was going to come in. But once the Bloodwing came in, it kind of made sense. And actually, I really enjoyed her seeing in her monologue and then taking the sword and leaving. It was a nice way to tie in the historical story with the main story.
And we're going to be addressing that sword more in the next two books coming up in the series.
Spoilers.
My guess would have been when I was reading this is that yes, the Enterprise would swoop down and beam McCoy out of the jaws of death using the stolen cloaking device. And when that did not happen, I was very happy.
I was under this impression too.
I also think that this book was, I believe I read, this wasn't exactly intended to be a continuation of the first book, My Enemy, My Ally. I mean, these writers were asked to write this story, and so, but Diane Duane still wanted to throw in her, you know, some of her characters that she had used in her previous story, which was great mm-hmm. because now we have the familiarity of other mm-hmm. characters besides the ones seen on the show. But this was, you know, how this is called part of the Rahansu series, but it wasn't called that originally. This was just a separate book. And then when they came out with the third book was when they decided to call it a series.
I know this is a bit off, but it's a lot like what happened with the Foundation series and the Robot series of Isaac Asimov. He wrote the first several books of the Robot series, 3 to 4 books into each of them. He decided he was going to tie them both together. And I think that's what happened here with the Bloodwing.
You know, I think that happens more often than a person suspects, that an author writes a book and really doesn't intend to go on to another story, but actually it becomes so popular, the first book becomes so popular that, oh yeah, you bet I'm going to write another one in this series.
Stop channeling Dune.
How can I help it? I read them all.
And podcasted them all.
Yes, I did. But this is not the Dune Saga podcast. This is Bound by Honor. So we better get back on where we are.
You mean you better stop making those shameless plugs?
Well, that's 2 years ago, so I'm not plugging much. All right, so should we move on to the next part of this book? The chapters were interspersed. There was a chapter from now, and then the next thing was a chapter from Teresa's report to the Federation on how the Romulan Star Empire came to be.
Wait, this is her report that we're reading?
I believe it is, yes.
I was under the impression that this was the report she read before she went into cover.
I just thought it was a history book.
Yes, I do believe the book says that she wrote the story from her impressions of what she knows about Romulan history. So it's supposed to look like she wrote the parts that we're reading from history.
Oh, okay, that's cool. I like that. That kind of puts a different spin on it than I had before. That's cool.
Yes, and it gives her more of a purpose for being there. Like, okay, she can also report on what happened and tell us, you know, from her perspective, oh, this is the way it went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, apparently she kept a very careful journal during her time on Romulus.
So what we have in the beginning is it starts when, in the time of Sorak, and you had the follower, the man Satask was the one who led the people away who eventually became the Romulans. What I thought was interesting is that Satask was actually a student of Sorak. So he was someone who followed the ways of, what did they call logic? They had some other translation for it. But he followed the...
Mockery, but I think that might be wrong. Oh, wait, that's the god. Never mind.
They will find it. But it was interesting. He followed Sorak first, and then he broke away. He wasn't someone who just right from the beginning said, oh, this man is just full of it. You know, I mean, he's someone who followed him first, which probably made it even harder for him and made it even harder for Sorak, which they mentioned, you know, Sorak seeing like his greatest pupil decide to leave.
I think that what you're looking for is the Kalanar.
The Kalanar was mm-hmm. the shredding of all emotion, but there was some other word they used for logic. It was a two-word something.
Kaswan?
I'll have to go look it up again. It was something like non-feeling. It wasn't that.
So apparently the Vulcan people were a very passionate group of people, a very passionate race. And then Sorak came along, and of course we know that he thought that these passions were ruling people's judgment and their behavior. And he felt that, of course, purging all this emotion would put a stop to the fighting and put a stop to everything, and then moving on to a pure sense of logic. And Satask, who was Sorak's student, as you pointed out, thought that, you know, maybe this was going a little bit too far, taking all the passion and everything out of the race, denying their own nature, and he felt that they needed to preserve this. Since they were in a minority, they felt that they had to leave Vulcan and find their own way.
I believe they were even encouraged to leave when they would not renounce the violence that they thought was driving a driving force in society to make society improve and improve and improve.
I like the idea that the banks bankrolled the ships just so they can own the patents on everything afterwards.
I think a lot of the stuff, a lot of the ideas coming out here were based on the fact that in human history, most technological developments are spurred on by wars or conflicts. And so the banks wanted to get their hands on all the ideas that Sataska and his followers were going to develop while they continued on to move away and perpetuate the, I don't know, violent tendencies they had, so that those conflicts could generate new ideas and new technology.
And it really reminds me of the Ferengi. One of the rules of acquisition is war is good for profit. Well, it turned out to be true for the Vulcans.
Yeah, but the next rule of acquisition is peace is good for profits.
Yes, that's true. They had both of them. And you could say that worked out too for the Vulcans. Once they became peaceful, once the other group left that became the Romulans, then Vulcan was actually united. They were never really united before, but once the other people left, then they were able to settle down and be peaceful.
Remember, Vulcan did not have warp drive at the time they left. So that was a whole new technology that was going to have to develop after these guys were gone.
That was interesting. They developed more technology, and yet, didn't they say it took several years for all of those ships to be built that Stask's people left on? So that it was great that they built these ships that could be, that they wanted to be able to last a while until the people could find a new planet, which took a long time.
According to the story, it took 500 years to find a new planet, and that was 500 years planet-side time, and then relativistic time would have been about 100 years of wandering.
And I think, didn't they say the ships were built to last 50 years?
Well, they were having lots of breakdowns and things, so they didn't last nearly as long as they had hoped.
They didn't find the planets as quickly as they hoped.
I think all of that makes sense when you think about space and how big it is. And there probably aren't many planets that are suitable for this type of life. There may be plenty of planets, but you know, not all of them you can live on. Not all of them can be colonized.
And they still had to not get the perfect environment what they were used to. They were used to a more dry environment, and they got something that was colder, but they accepted it.
Well, that kind of, you know, that explains the quilted uniforms that they wear now, that, you know, maybe it is a little colder.
I was under the impression that the new planet Romulus was, it was a little warmer. It's just that it wasn't the desert like a Vulcan.
Yeah,
Vulcan's considered more of a desert world. And then the other planet, Remus, was the one that was considered a colder planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thought I had was that they felt the planets were a little bit too lush for what they were used to,
but it turned out in their favor because they didn't have to put near as much effort into producing food and getting a hold of the resources as maybe the Vulcans had.
So the two planets, also there was more water, and that is something I remember reading, like in another novel. It was mentioned one time that the Vulcan, you know, doesn't have oceans, and that most Vulcans don't know how to swim, and that Spock's mother taught him how to swim, so at least Spock knew how to do that.
That's good, because he would have been a whale of a problem if he hadn't.
Yeah, it was in San Francisco Bay. It would have been a big problem if Spock had not learned how to swim.
So what do we think about the about how the females became so dominant, and the one woman, Terehu, in the past, that was such a ruler that was, how would we say it, more violent. She was very, very much in charge and very much knew what she wanted and ruled with an iron fist.
And wasn't she mentioned as being the only queen slash monarch that they had in their history?
Yes, they did say that. And it was something that they probably needed at the time to just all be under one ruler. But after that, yes, and that's a good explanation as to how they became what they are now with the Tricameron, and they want to make sure that no one part of it becomes too powerful.
Well, it seemed like she became the praetor, which was the executive who carried out the wishes of the houses of the Senate to make sure that things got done. But she was quite militaristic herself.
I think the term you're looking for is ruthless.
Well, the way she did away with Satask certainly would point in that direction.
And the way they were always referring to her as the boogeyman, this is why we have to keep the republic rather than going back to a monarchy.
Well, the last thing they wanted to do was fall back and become what the Vulcans were trying to become. And so they needed somebody that was firm and to make sure. Satask, of course, as a former student of Surak, might have said, well, you know, maybe they were right. Maybe we need to look at what they were doing. And she had to say, no, we are going to be different. This is the way it's going to be.
Task was one of the few people, or maybe the only one, that was one of the original people who left Vulcan. Remember, he was very old at this time, and most of the others had died out.
Yeah, he was something like 248 or something like that.
But another important part of this history that we haven't quite touched on yet is the fact that they took with them, as they left, 5 specific swords from a specific sword maker on Vulcan, who was considered to be the expert at this. And one of the swords that is the one that is on the empty chair that is confiscated by the Bloodwing commander at the end was given to Satask by Surak.
My impression was that all of the swords were given to him for safekeeping, but he apparently just took that one with him.
Did it say that all the swords were given to him, but somehow only one of them survived in the end?
Yeah, it was something like that.
Survived the trip or survived the launch?
Survived by the time they reached Romulus.
Yeah, and that's the one that ends up on the empty chair as a symbol. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't that sword go on the empty chair after the queen, or was it before and during the queen's time also?
It was after the queen. Was it when she used the same sword to kill Stask, and then after she was overthrown, it was left in that chair as a symbol? I think once they had the sword left in the chair, and then that would be like the chair was at the head of the table.
That chair was from when Sirk died. They put it on Satak's old chair, and it sat there forever, and she put a throne in front of it because she didn't want to touch the sword. But she didn't want to see it anymore either.
Okay, so once they reached Romulus, they had the table and Stask was there, right? I mean, he had his chair on the council, and so later on, Terehu put the sword on his old chair.
It was his old chair from the ship, from what I understood, and then he brought another chair in. Isn't the sword thing start after his old master died, as a symbol of what they left behind, or something like that?
A symbol of what they left behind on Vulcan, because all those swords were made by the greatest sword master on Vulcan.
Yep.
And so, as you mentioned, Surak took the swords and gave them to Stask as, you know, a remembrance.
One of the things that I found very interesting was after everything was established, the Romulan people, or the Riansu, had developed a completely different language. They wanted to be absolutely nothing like Vulcans. They developed a language, they developed religion, They developed art forms and literature. Now, that part to me was really, really neat, because that's getting into some depth on a society when you start talking about their art and literature. I really appreciated that part of this book.
Yeah, I did too. And I was trying to think, we were discussing it throughout the week. Is this an allegory for any other civilizations? We couldn't think of anything in our modern societies like that when people break away, like when there was a breakaway from the British coming to America. There's American English and British English, but they're both English. Can you think of any other societies that actually broke away and developed their own language? I think that was pretty severe.
That's not something that I know of in history, but one of the things that I equated in this story in history was the Greeks and then the Romans, okay? The Romans set up their system of government, their style of everything. They created their art and everything based on what the Greeks had done, because throughout our own history, peoples that of Western civilization have always tried to get back to the classical values, referring to Greek values as far as art is concerned, as far as music is concerned. This was kind of a complete opposite of that, where the Romulan people did not want anything to do with being like the Vulcans.
And one thing I appreciated about how this book handled that is that it immersed us into the Romulan language by putting the glossary in back. It's just like reading the Dune books or the Silmarillion. You're forced to think like the Romulans or the Rian'Sanu because of, you have to keep going back and forth and learn their language as you're reading the passages.
The glossary in the back was a big help reading the book, yes.
But I think that, to the credit of the writer, you didn't need to go back to the glossary to keep going with the story.
Yeah, yes, the different words were, it was okay to just keep reading, not know exactly the meaning of the words. You could kind of figure it out and keep reading the book. So that was good too, that it didn't interrupt your flow of the book.
So then as time went on and the Romulans continued to develop their society, and the Vulcans began working on purging emotion as a motivation for doing things, it seems like the Romulans were forgotten and left to be on their own. Of course, they did not at first have warp technology, and it even got to the point where nobody knew that the Romulans had been Vulcans in centuries past.
That's true.
And that was how we came up with the story for Balance of Terror, because nobody knew what the Romulans looked like at that time.
Now that brings up an interesting question about this story in general, and maybe the second half of the story. The Vulcans were kind of on the ground, where it seemed to be on the ground floor of the Federation, where in this book it said that the Vulcans joined the Federation quite a bit later after its formation. So is this book in continuity, or should it just be brushed off?
The book is not canon, and it may have been the accepted story up until First Contact, and then that kind of blew the idea of this book being an accurate story right away. But at the same time, this is about Romulans and about their development, and not necessarily about Vulcans and humans. Until, of course, we get to the next section of the story, which is the Romulan War.
Another interesting thing in the book is the first contact between the Romulans and the Federation. And so the book explains it goes back to Vulcan, and there was another race they called the Etotians that later became the Orions, about how they tricked the Vulcans and, said we come in peace, but then attacked them. And that is the reason that the Romulans attacked the Federation almost on first sight, after the Federation said something like, we come in peace. And on the side of Starfleet and the Federation, they never knew. They just thought, well, this is a violent race because they attacked us for no reason. But then when you see the Romulans' point of view of it, they had their reason. It was because of the history that had happened to them before.
And as a result of that reason, they started building ships, thousands of ships. And when Federation went to Romulus, the single ship that went there was immediately surrounded and overcome, even though the firepower on the Federation ship was way better. And then when they sent a fleet of ships to retaliate for that attack, even that fleet had been overwhelmed. It was very interesting, but they did not have warp drive at the time. And I thought it was really cool that the Romulans developed warp drive by salvaging pieces of Federation ships that they had overcome.
The Romulans basically beat off the Federation just through pure tenacity. I mean, they could do it because they were determined mostly, not mm-hmm. because, and you know, because the superior technology should have won, but they were determined.
Mm-hmm. See, and this is another point of canon in the book, because in Next Generation, we find out that the Romulans drive their ships from controlled quantum singularities in their engine. So I wonder how that would change over from what this book says into what they came up with in Next Generation.
It would be interesting to see someone try to fit this in with established canon.
Speaking of their technologies, there's a reference in the book to the Romulan Empire being upset with the fact that they consider themselves to be half owned by the Klingons because of all the trading that's been going on with the Klingon Empire. And yeah, it kind of smacked me with the thought that the United States had the same ideas going through their heads back in the 80s, back when these books were being written, between Japan and China buying up, and the trade deficits that they were running with these countries.
That is a very interesting parallel, and I do like that the book does mention the Klingons. It was established in the Enterprise incident, you know, when they said that the Romulans are now using Klingon design. So of course we do know that there has been a treaty with the Klingons.
They seem to get along quite well, because the Klingons obtained their cloaking device from the Romulans. So apparently the Romulans were the first to come up with a cloaking device.
Yes.
That is the way I always thought it was. Yeah, the Romulans came up with that. So they did have their own scientists who were brilliant and could come up with new technology.
And I also read into the book that the Romulan ships were superior to Klingon ships in everything, with the exception of weaponry, that the Klingons had very well-developed weaponry, whereas the Romulans did not.
I was going to bring up the point that you all understand why there is such a close trading relationship between the Klingon Empire trading ships to the Romulan Empire, don't you?
Enlighten me.
The Romulan ship for the first season of TOS was destroyed, so by the time they got around to filming the Enterprise incident, they needed another alien spaceship, and all they had were the Klingon D-7s.
You do know the real story behind that, don't you?
Which, enlighten me.
They had actually built a model for the show that was a Romulan ship, completely different than the Klingon ship. And what happened was, is apparently somebody was walking through the model shop and didn't have lights on or something like that, and stepped right in the middle of the Romulan ship model. And it was like they didn't have time to fix it before filming. So, what are we going to do? I'll just throw the Klingon D-7 up there and say that the Romulans are now using Klingon design.
Which is what I was trying to say, but you've got more details.
And so anyway, it's kind of neat how an accident like that just kind of comes around and comes back and gets absorbed into the story and accepted by fandom.
And I believe also that the designer of the Romulan ship, when they did have a budget later on to make it again, he was not in the union, so that they couldn't bring his ship back in, and they couldn't bring him back in. So there was production problems later on when they were able to make a Romulan ship. So it's multi-layered why we only saw the Bird of Prey once and why we saw the Romulans use Klingon ships multiple times.
Even the Bird of Prey in Star Trek IV was designed to be a Romulan ship, and they cut out a scene where the Bird of Prey decloaks and destroys a bunch of D7s, and there's supposed to be some reference to it. And because cutting that whole scene, eventually the Bird of Prey just became a Klingon ship.
You know, that's just why Star Trek is so much fun, because we've got all these neat little things we can talk about.
A fan hobby is to pick out the holes, plot holes, in all of Star Trek's episodes, movies, and books.
And then try to make sense out of them. So it really is not a plot hole, but it's purposeful.
Yeah, it's neat when fandom can do that, especially now at a point where fandom seems to be more fighting and arguing and condemning and things like that.
I mean, just talking about the about this book and those kind of things, I mean, it is fun to talk about, and we don't really have to argue. It's just something like, hey, it's just something that's fun to discuss.
And also what's unique about Diane Duane is that she's one of the few novelists that was also involved in the production of Star Trek. So she co-wrote one of the Star Trek The Next Generation episodes. So it's obviously that when the producers saw her work to invite her on to the show, there was a lot of merit to her passion for Star Trek and the quality of her output of her novels.
And that's historic with Star Trek, because if you go back and look at the original series, almost 50% of the episodes were written by, and I probably get that number too high, were written by science fiction writers of the time that were not hired by Paramount or Desilu Studios.
Okay, well, let's go into favorite points of plot in the book. We may have already covered those. I personally, as I said, I kind of really enjoyed McCoy's diatribe, his filibuster.
Filibuster.
Yeah, filibuster in front of the Romulan Senate. I mean, that, just imagining that, had me in stitches.
Nobody can filibuster like a Southern gentleman. It's even mentioned in the book.
And about you, Javon, what was your favorite point of plot in this?
When I think her name was Ale from the first book, came in and took the sword and gave her speech. I really liked that part because it really tied the two halves of the book together.
Okay, and Kathy?
I would have to say all of the scenes with Arai as the head servant. It shows that she was confident, she knew her job, and she could fit in well with these people. She could be a leader, and she could also be a follower. I mean, it was just a great character.
And Jorn?
Don't forget Ryan. But to answer the question, I really wish they would have found a way to make it more of a story arc, but it would have needed its own book. The history. The every other chapter history is what I probably think was more impressive to me than most of the rest of the book.
Okay, and Ryan, the unforgettable.
Yeah, I'm going to have to side with Jorn on that as well. I spent more time thinking about the history of the Romulan people and how they developed as their own culture. That half of the book, those every other chapters, were the ones that I appreciated far more so.
All right, how would you rate this book? And we'll just go in reverse order that we went in. So, Ryan, you would be up.
I'm going to give it 4 Romulan stars out of 5.
Okay, and John?
I'm going to have to stick with about 2 or 3 because, and you know, I'm not going with Romulan stars, just the regular stars here. You know, we're Klingons here, not necessarily Romulans. But I wish the history would have been more of a story arc. And the story arc that I did see, I did have some problems with.
Okay. And Kathy?
I want to go with 5 out of 5 because I really enjoyed the book. To me, it was just my kind of story. I love the Romulans, and I loved both of the storylines in the book.
Okay. And Sean?
I'll give it a 3. If the McCoy stuff had McCoy being there and being this undercover agent made a little bit more sense, I would easily give this book a 4 instead. But I'm going to have to keep it as 3 the way it is.
Okay, and I am going to go with 4 out of 5 myself. I'm not going to be as harsh on the McCoy storyline because I did find it at least entertaining and not terribly distracting once I suspended my disbelief and accepted that, okay, McCoy's going to do this. McCoy either volunteered or was appointed to do this. And I kind of, as I mentioned before, made some justifications for that in my own mind so that I could enjoy the story. And let's move into closing thoughts and wrap this one up.
So I will say again, I think it was an excellent book, and the other books in this series, I look forward to reviewing with you.
Yeah, I believe that out of the Star Trek novels of the numbered series, oftentimes they're hit or miss. This one definitely is worth reading because primarily of it gives us a more of a background of Romulans, and that's something that's sorely lacking in quite a few of the older Star Trek novels.
And if you think about this book as being a bridge between My Enemy, My Ally and Sword Hunt, which is the next one, the fact that it gives a lot of Romulan texture so that we can understand what's going on in the books makes it more of a Romulan cultural experience for the reader.
I still look forward to reading the other 3. Despite my feelings on this book, I still really like the other half of it, and I like how it fleshed out the culture. And I'm hoping that you guys say it's bridging the gap between the rest of the series, so I look forward to seeing how this weaves in with it. And maybe in hindsight, I would change my opinion of this book, because unlike you guys, I haven't actually read any of these books except as we're going through these reviews.
And to get back to the point of you accusing me of giving out spoilers, the title of the next book in this series is Sword Hunt.
Ah, spoilers!
Only if you don't ever, ever go to a bookstore.
Does Amazon count?
Amazon may soon be the only bookstore we have.
At the rate things are going. All right, my closing thoughts are, I did enjoy the book. At first, I was a little bit confused as I read into it. What is this history thing going on in between the action chapters? But once I figured out what was going on, I could accept it. Now, our overall rating for this book comes out at a 3.8. Something I just thought I would throw in there that's kind of interesting to me is that Goodreads gives it a 3.9.
Hey, yeah, us.
Oh, God, we're going with everybody else.
So, yeah, I'd say that we are probably fairly well representative of what many others thought about this book.
But getting back to the point that you had just made, Jim, about not catching the difference in the chapters, I think this probably is one of those books that really gets a little bit better when you give it a second reading, because you figured out this is what the book is going to do, and now you can look at why it's doing it that way and how it works doing it that way.
I totally agree. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we're going to move on. Hey, Sean. You want to tell us what we're reading next time?
We are reading Hidden Universes and Travel Guides, Star Trek The Klingon Empire by Dayton Ward.
And it's also been rumored that Dayton Ward will be joining us for that show.
Keep in mind, listeners, that this is going to be a different kind of book. We're probably going to have a slightly different format for how we go about talking about it, especially if we can get the author here to query him about why he did that or that, or maybe even that.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what, it would be kind of neat if listeners, if you have questions about this book, if you have it and you've read it and gone through it and you have questions that you would like to pass along to Dayton, you know, send them in to us. We'll be more than happy to pass those along for you. And where can our listeners send in those questions and comments, Javon?
Well, if they want to email us, they can email us at podcast@keg.org. They can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, all on Keg Podcast. And if they want to make sure I see their particular questions for Dayton Ward, try to attach it to my post saying that we're reading the Klingon Empire, or even on Goodreads, tag it on the book in our Goodreads group, which I guess I could share again.
Sure.
Or, more importantly, write your question on a $20 bill and send it to
us.
Sell out.
Well, that would be a very, very sure way to get your question on the air. So that's this episode of Bound by Honor. It was a fun one. It was an interesting one. And I would like to thank Ryan and Kathy for joining us.
Thank you for having us. It was our pleasure to be here. And we look forward to the next one.
As always, it's always a pleasure.
The next time Kathy and Ryan will be joining us is when we review the next book in this series, which is Sword Hunt by Diane Duane.
All right. So, for the Bound by Honor podcast, I am Jajim.
I'm Jorn.
And I'm Javon.
And join us next time. Kapla.
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 Oh, no. To our Romulan friends, we say Jolan True.
Jolan True.
Kapla.
All right.
Thank you.
So long, everybody.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kapla!
Romulus est, Remus est, nam de Chifritex.